Welcome to this edition of What the Fuck Happenings Here. In opposition, yeah, that would probably be it. So another week transitioning from making a bunch of arguments to making sort of the argument in some sort of sequence that can be more persuasive or compelling as an argument. And there are people who argue that there is no truth and that we can't know the truth. And, you know, I've pointed out in previous videos, I think all the facts that give you enough information, enough visibility to do the simple thing of just stacking, you know, the little blocks on top of each other in the right order, or putting the puzzle pieces together. You know, they're not really small, tiny little pieces with no information. We sort of have sort of big, glaring pieces, and it's kind of an easy puzzle to put together. And the only thing that messes you up is if you have a bunch of erroneous pieces, you know, just misinformation and nonsense, and you try to cram that into the story. I would argue that it is sensible to believe the universe is a coherent thing, that it has a real history and a real story, and there's only one story. You know, it's not a whole bunch of universes all doing the same thing a little tiny bit differently. Those are just made up kind of puzzle pieces. You know, you can do that. You can take a piece from over there and you can stick it onto some other piece and you can start breaking the pieces into pieces. But there's no point in doing that. There's no logic to it. There's no compelling reason to believe it. The simple answer is that it's a sequence of events, and that's what we see life happening as. We don't see anything that gives us any indication that there is any power to control time or to, alter the story on the deterministic look way back and dissect what took place. It's a sequence of events is all, you know, and it's a coherent one. It's a real story, not any story. And it's the story isn't a story. It's a sequence of real events, not just made up ones. Anyway, and you draw conclusions based on, you know, putting together the story, the model of how it happened. And science can help a lot in terms of detailing and compiling evidence for, the boundary of the puzzle pieces. Can give you lots of clues as to how they go together and can reveal them, can shine light on them to make them more visible, however you want to metaphor it. And it can also expose the fake, phony pieces that are glued together with nonsense like faith, you know, concepts like that. And then you get into sort of the science of being reasonable, and then you get into philosophy, and you can make sensible philosophical arguments about the storytelling of the past and how, you know, it makes no sense at all to sit there and watch a trial thousands of years later, okay, and where you can never examine the witnesses and, you know, find out how credible this fable is and believe it. I mean, it's just a prescription for failure to get the right answer. Then some sort of way to get the right answer is to believe anything a human being says. And so all of religion is just nonsensical in the context of any fair, rational, in the context of context. Giving it proper context, it makes no sense. The context of human beings separated by distance make up completely different religious stories, nothing really in common. They'll pretend, oh yeah, they all came up with the same God. No, they really didn't. You know, they're all kinds of different stories. And they don't have much in common at all, except the ones that are built out of each other, like languages that are built out of whatever you call the original letters But yeah, they reformulate them into all kinds of different patterns. So anyway, so right there, there's reason to be suspect of all of them, because they all have no credibility. It's just stories told by long dead witnesses who, you know, watched the miracles. You know, the miracles aren't really miracles, you know. I mean, you can sort of, again, logically deduce that they couldn't have been very impressive if people weren't very durable in their faith, you know, their belief. And clearly they weren't. And then people who were, you know, it's like the Christian religion, huge inconsistencies. You know, Moses talks to God in the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, Jesus accuses Moses of placating people and, you know, making up laws that, you know, didn't come from God, but came from his own political decision-making, like divorce. and so basically it's telling us that Moses didn't really talk to God, that his laws weren't from God. Huge contradictions all over the place, silly stories, and yet people are going to judge what it is to be alive and what it means to be human and all of that based on these silly premises. And some people will say it just doesn't matter. You can talk and argue about what we should do based on any wacky premise. And I would argue that can't do anything but get you the wrong answer. If you don't know the answer, then you shouldn't do anything aggressive, right? I mean, that would be the argument. You can't make any aggressive decisions if you're going to claim that that ignorance is systemic and there's no way to overcome it. So, you know, I've argued before that the first people you want to shoot in a war are the fence sitters. They're the most dangerous people. Choose a side or die, you know, first, because you're just too useless. Because I don't see any room for disagreement in a rational, reasonable conversation. What people believe and what they state to be true is you can demonstrate it to be nonsense. I mean, by its very definition, again, faith, its very definition is saying, I don't need to be reasonable. I don't have to have evidence. You know, I don't have to have reason to believe. Well, if you're doing that, then you're doing something fundamentally catastrophically wrong. You're just basically saying intelligence has no meaning. And there are people saying that. They're going to argue about what knowledge is. And yeah, you know, obviously it's a consequence of some kind of understanding. You know, and I would say that knowledge might be accurate understanding. But anyway, there's all these words and how to use them. Has become part of a debate, and pretty much just, you know, it's these fringes that always make so much noise, the squeaky wheel kind of thing, and so you always have to pay attention to them. But they force the issue. The drunken heckler, you know, there's no mute button, can't shut them up. So whatever distractions they'll force, you have to indulge, just because they're so rude. So you have to deal with the false and phony arguments and accusations and statements. So I'll do some of that, but I'm not going to do it in any direct way, I don't think. But yes, I don't see any possibility of arguing from a confused or some sort of model that you have no confidence in about anything, you know, just about anything important. If you're going to make an important decision and you don't have information, you're claiming nobody does, then, you know, then you might as well just pick the answer out of a hat. Yeah, might as well just flip coins. No point in having a war over it. And such. So, I've argued that, again, it's not that complicated to dissect our existence and understand it in the context of the universe and all of that stuff and physical facts. Starts with physics, starts with some mechanism that does some energy thing that takes place, and it has these rules of conservation, and you know, the stuff going this way has to be compensated by, well, if there's stuff going this way where you are, then there must be stuff going that way somewhere out there. The other half of that story is out there somewhere. And through that simple physics of stuff moving, and there's stuff, and then there's non-stuff, and you know, the process of time is just basically a measurement of the fact that there's no instantaneous movement. Things can't go from point A to point B instantaneously, so there's time. And anyway, through that process, you end up with something called chemistry. So you move from physics to this idea of the compound. So the physics gives you the fundamental elements, the little atoms that are all kind of shaped subtly different, and they fit together in different ways. And so with 100 different little atoms, you can make lots and lots of different kinds of combinations. And that's chemistry, compounds, where you put a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of that, and it makes a funny little shape, and that funny little shape does particular things that the other shapes can't do, and you get interesting different compounds. And through that process, we ended up with a DNA molecule. Lots of other molecules that are kind of like DNA. I mean, they're stringy, and we call them proteins because they're long chains of repeating code. But the DNA has this little special feature where its code is basically a copying device, in the sense that it makes two rungs to its to the ladder, and it's able to be split and recombine into two new ladders by just splitting the ladder in half. You create a left and a right, and the left hand makes a new right, and the right hand makes a new left, and you end up with a copied of the original sequence in the molecule. And so once you have that molecule, so this was sort of like the evolution of chemistry, is that you would mix these chemicals in places like the surface of the earth, and there'd be a lot of different kinds of chemistry mixing, lots of different trials and errors, so to speak, of things that were durable and things that weren't. And the catch with the DNA molecule is that it became durable because it just kept replicating. So if you had one of them, you end up with two of them, and then you end up with three of them and four of them. They didn't have to remix. They didn't have to go through the process of, you know, all the stuff swirling and all kinds of stuff happening. They just replicate. And inside of us is relatives of those original DNA molecules. There's where the consequence of that, our ancestor actually was just some a DNA molecule, the original one, and all of us, all living things, are a byproduct of that single molecule learning by circumstance, having the capacity to do this funky thing of break into two pieces. And so the other part of it that's kind of important is the fact that it can be broken into two pieces based on being in an isolated environment, an environment that is conducive to remaking the parts, having the right parts around to remake the two pieces. And the DNA molecule is essentially something that can be, it can interact with other chemicals, and other chemicals can stick to one end and then slide down the DNA molecule and be converted through the process into other chemicals. So the DNA molecule becomes a little chemical engine that can make new chemicals. And then those chemicals end up just in, by circumstance, the ones that are going to be durable, the ones that the DNA molecule is going to keep making, are ones that are conducive to its growth and population, its capacity to replicate, its capacity to make copies. So it's going to make, by circumstance, through having a certain arrangement, a certain code on its surface, it makes a chemical that more efficiently splits the molecule in half, so it can replicate even quicker and more efficiently. And it creates other chemicals, end up creating a membrane that prevents chemicals it doesn't need from getting into the mixing bowl, and cleans and makes it more and more efficient. And so Then you have essentially the first cell. You have a membrane made by the DNA molecule, the way back in the original molecule, that's very efficient at protecting and feeding the molecule in terms of its ability to become stronger and stronger as a replicator and have features that are going to make it durable in the environment. So things that are conducive to its replication means it survives as a molecule, and surviving just means it consumes resources and holds on to them, keeps them in its form. The chemicals don't get back into the bowl again. So it's monopolizing the available elements and atoms and keeping them in this form and making more DNA out of them. So, you know, that's the real history. And then once you have the DNA molecule, you have then the evolution of that is into the first cell. And then the cells did something a little tricky at one point that made even more complex life possible. In the sense that one cell, you know, one kind of DNA cell, there was another kind that had evolved a little bit differently, had different chemistry, and the two of them combined, and one of them became the nucleus of the other. So they ended up with two membranes. And this was a one-time event in history, but it's one of those one-time events that led to a huge expansion in terms of what kind of complexity would be possible, because now you've made even more secure the DNA molecule by creating a second wall to the exterior world, and a second way of controlling the chemistry around the molecule to make it more and more efficient in terms of not breaking and all the things that are necessary to create a chemical machine. So it became more efficient at that. And so once you had the single cell, then you have a whole lot of different kinds of single cell organisms. The DNA molecule is just, it's the different little bugs that have a single cell and a nucleus. They all can be differentiated by looking at them. They're very different. Some have little, you know, little legs, little moving parts that allow them to move through the fluid. Others have, you know, big mouth. Others have drilling things, all kinds of little machines. And the machines just represent that the code is different on the molecules. Those molecules evolved different. They evolved over there, and this one evolved over there. And by being separated, they evolved differently. They were they had a different life experience. They had a different physical interaction with the universe. And those physically different conditions ended up with a fundamentally different end product. And you can just see, you just look at it, you can see the difference, and the difference is there's a different DNA molecule. It's a related molecule, it has a common ancestor, but the two molecules have branched off. You know, I point out, you know, just saying the word branch, that, you know, I've made these arguments, you know, about how some facts are really durable and reliable. And it's like when somebody says, how was the word invented? And the point is you could say something like, saying water is wet is a very reliable fact. Because the word wet was invented, created, for the very purpose of describing the experience of interacting with water. That's what it does. And the word branch is, again, another kind of reliable word, in the sense that you know that its origin is likely tree branch. You know, that's the first time somebody said, let's call that thing a branch. And yeah, maybe the original word was a different sound, maybe it was made of different letters, but the concept of branch, you know, that's where it comes from. So saying something like branching or whatever, you get the concept. And you could say the same thing about two. Two isn't something is, it's a property it has. It's a two-ness. Things come in the world, and you can say, well, what's the property of this battery? And you can list a whole bunch of properties. And then when I put another one right next to it, though, I've added another property to both of them. They both have now two-ness, because there's two of them. It's a property. It exists as a real thing, as a concept. that you can take two-ness plus two-ness and end up with four-ness. This is reliable stuff. You know, you can give it that 99.99% kind of true statements. And that's the only point being made, is there's a big difference between things we can say with real authority as truth and things that are, you know, less certain. And I would argue that the best statement is one that says it perfectly accurately. Now, I've said some things about DNA that might not be perfectly stated, but I would argue the concept has been fairly and accurately described in terms of the process. That we know there wasn't the hand of God in there somewhere. You know, God wasn't making microbes. And it's clear also that the DNA that's inside of us was inside of simpler things. And we have a lot of that old code is still sitting inside of us. We still have the code to make a tail, still in our DNA. And every now and then somebody's born with one. Just a fact that there's no denying our origins. No reasonably sensible person can deny what the facts add up to in terms of recognizing the truth of it. So anyway, back to so we're at the single cell organisms, lots of diversity, lots of little machines being made that have, you know, no real function except to consume mass and own it. And own it to their progeny. Keep the atomic bits controlled by a DNA molecule that's competing with other DNA molecules. And their ability to exist in the future, whether they will or will not, is just a simple fact that they must do certain things. Now, they're going to do them on purpose, but they're just going to do them by the circumstance of what they bang into and whether they win the race just by being lucky. Banging into the right stuff, having the right experiences to distinguish themselves from the other guy, and that code will be replicated and it'll own mass and it'll own atoms, and the other code won't, and so it won't make it into the future because it'll just disappear. It'll die as a code for building a good machine. The only ones that'll survive the contest and are lucky in terms of their interactions win. And that's pretty much how it works for the little cellular bits. They're always, the microbes are constantly competing for space to own. And there's lots of rules for how you survive doing that, especially when now the microbes live in a world full of bigger organisms that can find the microbes a yummy meal. So they have to now live a kind of different life than they might have in their Jurassic period, their period of where they only lived, where they were the biggest thing walking, squiggling through the earth, moving through the chemistry. But yeah, there's lots of rules to that evolution for them now that's different than the rules that existed when the world was just microbes. But the bottom line is your survival requires a strategy, a kind of a plan, but it's not a plan written ahead of time. It's written through the process of trial and error. So it's just a huge experiment being conducted by the molecule. The molecule makes a whole bunch of children, and the plan is kill most of them, and the one that survive will be well equipped to write the plan for the building of the next ones, and the next ones, and the next ones. And so the plan is to put out as many of your competitors as possible. That's, you know, some organisms produce millions of children, you know, for this purpose. That's one way of winning, is to saturate the environment. Another way of winning is to take a little more time to make your copies and to give them features that take a little more time to make, and give them tools that make them stronger. And so that's another strategy, is give them more of a head start. Don't throw them out into the world as a spore and force them to grow out in the real world that might take advantage of their less than complete condition. So the more complete you can put them into the world, the more likely it is they're going to survive in a lot of environments. That'll be the truth. In some other environment, it's not going to matter. It's just going to be a numbers game, attrition. You're all equal enough that the way you win is just to make more of yours. We've sort of become that now. The human race is sort of demonstrating that now. We've broken all the rational survival rules. Well, all the, I won't call them rational, all the natural ones that provided some standard for what was defined as a survivable or a well-made. And we've sort of said you don't have to be well-made anymore. You can be pretty broken and still survive, which is a nice little civilization thing. It's nice that things aren't getting killed for stupid reasons, what would seem like stupid or unnecessary reasons, like they just have a small defect. But the downside is once you allow defects to survive, and less than optimum construction, that's what you're going to get in the future, is more and more of that, because the breeding rules aren't tied to success and failure anymore. It's exactly the inverse. For the human race, the more successful, the more competent, the more capable you are of navigating the system, the less likely you are to have kids, and the less capable you are of doing anything reasonable and functional, the more likely you are to accidentally make the mistake of having kids you can't provide for, that have your kind of failure code. So that's sort of a more advanced part of evolution, when you start getting into how we change it with our philosophies and with our memes and ideas. So we're back at the cell. That's where we were. So let's go back to the original argument, the progression. So first it was just single cells, and they made little machines out of the single cell. And then there was a change in evolution, in the sense that those single cells sort of fell upon the idea that if they did clump together as a little family or as a group of cells, that they would be more survivable in that form than spread out individually. That by creating a gang, they could create cells that had slightly different functions. So you could have protecting cells, and you could have skin cells, and you could have layers of your structure where there'd just be slight differences, but you could end up creating a kind of a community that had rules about how it's shaped. And those rules would make it more conducive for feeding and for avoiding getting killed. And so you had sponges and different kinds of organisms that were based on this principle of collection of cells. And then that leads to something sort of complex, like a jellyfish, where the cells become very individual, the community of cells. But there's no strict organization. It's just kind of a very simply organized arrangement of different cells. No central controlling mechanism. Just cells with different functions stuck together, doing different things. So kind of like organs of the body, except not having one instrument to control everything. Each instrument was sort of on its own, just did its own thing. And I suppose some of our organs are like that. There isn't much central control. there's just some hormones and chemistry to, keep them comfortable, but they're really living almost as if they were independent organisms. So anyway, but that's again going a step further than where we are. So sponges and algaes and different kinds of things became community organisms. Mobs works. So becoming a mob, a tribe, a bunch of thugs, a gang, there was a huge advantage to doing that. And and it would be advantageous because even if the gang becomes just a gang of similar but different varieties of the same thing, they all have a kind of common code that they're going to end up sharing. So even if one dies for the other, they're still dying for their kind. So there's, again, evolutionary advantage in that kind of gang warfare. So once that begins, then you end up with much more complicated organisms that create individual organs that do specific things. You end up with skeleton, bone structures, all kinds of different features and mechanical devices, eyeballs, all kinds of sensing organs. Well, at first that comes with neurons, but the first eyeball didn't have any neurology tied to it, let's say. It was just a way of detecting and sensing the world outside by putting certain chemicals on the surface that would react to sunlight, and the reaction would be chemically experienced by the rest of the body. The messages were sent chemically. And then the big change was when it became the first neuron. So all the organisms that are, experiencing some sort of consciousness are all based on neurons making it. There's no other example of any other mechanism that allows organisms to do complex memory association tasks where they can learn and they have a place to store their experiences and evaluate them and then regurgitate them, have their brain bring back an experience in the past to create a behavior in the future. So there's only one mechanism that does any of this thinking and feeling thing, and that's based on the existence of a neuron. And neurons were this specialty cell created that could transfer information much quicker. So if the mouth needed to know what was happening, the front end needed to know what the back end was doing, it could know it very fast instead of having to wait for chemicals to, and speed became everything. Everything's reacting in a very fast world by mechanical standards. The faster you are, the more reactive you are. You can understand that if your reflexes are quicker, you're going to win fights because you're going to be able to maneuver and evade the teeth that are coming to chomp you. The teeth are moving slow compared to how fast you can evade them because you have these sense organs that can know things much quicker than your predators can anticipate. And anticipating is part of what the neurons eventually can do. They can program through this, through their use, connecting, creating a network of information, creating a little computer, a capacity to store information and have reflexive responses that aren't physical, that are electrical. And the electrical responses are, much faster, a million times faster, maybe. That's just a tool, an advancement in the machine. So you have these organisms that are equipped with this capacity to do this more advanced function, this tool, and those would, it seems kind of obvious that they would start to win a lot of battles for survival and that they would do more replicating. And the other organisms are still there because they're functional. So the microbes are still existing in their puddles because they can't have complexity because they're living in a little tiny world, a little tiny drop of water. They can't have the complexity we have because there's nothing to make it out of physically. There's not enough physics for them to work with to create that complexity. The evolution requires big physics, big chemistry. You can't make a tiny neuron kind of thing. They do have to be a certain minimum size to function. So then you get to that minimum size thing, and you have things like tiny little ants, you know, just tiny, tiny things that have clearly very sophisticated routines, programs that are kept inside of their neurons, and these neurons are all arranged by the DNA molecule in its creation as part of the chain reaction process of making a new ant. And the neurons are specifically arranged and pre-programmed with certain reflexive behaviors where they trigger 15 or 20 or 100 or 1,000 different mechanical things to take place to make the ant move in particular ways. And it's all reflexes. It's all pre-programmed behavior, walking and doing their maneuvering. With how much extra goes into that, you know, how much of it is, how much learning they can do. But they can, in fact, learn. You can teach ants that food is, turn right and you get more food, and they'll learn, turn right, get more food. So their brain is doing the same thing ours is doing in the sense that it's experiencing the environment, learning how to manipulate it by past experience. Past experience teaches you everything, everything that you are and everything you're going to say and every way you're going to say it. It's all part of what you've been exposed to in the past. Your little pieces of your whole history is mixed up inside of you. Every one of the events, from crib to where you are now, is part of who you are as a stored bit of information. As a piece of information, and your brain obviously can't absorb it all and take in everything, but it's selecting the important bits, and there's bits it's selecting for that you aren't even aware of, in the sense that you see something and you didn't really notice how much red or black or green was in the picture you're looking at, but your brain did. And so it's associating things with color, it's associating things with all kinds of different ways, and that's what comes out when you are expressing your aliveness and having an experience. The experience is the byproduct of that. It comes out of your subconscious, creates it all. It's mechanically learned, the right reflexive response, how to manipulate your throat and your mouth and your gestures and when do your hands get involved. All of that's being, dictated by a bunch of pre-written programs that are essentially made out of years of experience. So yeah, that's, and again, going a little further than the story, the ant story, because the ant story illustrates the next level in the evolution, in the sense of the creation of colonies of organisms. Now the organism has a bunch of organs, legs and antennas and eyes and all kinds of different ways of tools, and now the colony, it recolonizes again. So much like the sponge, that started with a bunch of cells that decided to become a colony, a mob, a group, the organism created by the sponge ends up becoming a group of sponges, that end up ganging up together to create a colony. And the colony now can do lots of things that the individual ant can't do. In terms of, they can excavate a whole civilization, they can build for themselves a place to live, they can do lots of things that the single ant couldn't do on its own or couldn't do nearly as effectively. So there becomes a great strength, and then now the individual ants can also be made to be warrior ants or nursery ants or queen and king kind of ants. They can have all kinds of variety. So just like the organs, they can just become part of a network of beings that are, now the DNA is writing into the code colony behavior, and a whole bunch of evolution is now again possible in terms of how the colonies organize the work to work to pleasure ratio. Well, I guess ants don't get to worry about that, But just the functionality, how efficient the colony is at producing. And so now the colonies of bees, for example, all compete with each other in terms of, again, they're in the game to make bees a very popular form of chemistry. You know, the one they're just going to consume matter from the universe and turn it into bees. And that's the competition they're in, is to have more matter in the form of your kind of bee. And so the more efficient these colonies are in terms of how they're strictly designed and the rules of interaction and behavior becomes very important. And so little failures in the function of the colony will mean it's going to lose in the survival battle. And so it becomes more and more efficient. And you see that in these incredibly efficient functionality of insect colonies. And again, so it's another kind of evolution, another an attribute of our evolution, still being controlled by the DNA molecule, but providing all kinds of opportunity for some adaptation to the environment. But the DNA molecule strictly, has a hard time learning without physical change. So without making a physical change, it can't, can't put a college education into the DNA molecule in any strict sense without taking away the process of learning. You have to somehow make the learning just some sort of trial and error thing over a long period of time, where we can learn a lot in a short period of time, but it's not transferable education. Yeah, I should be back. Can look. Yeah, looks like I'm back. Probably could put mini me up here. Yeah, there. Two of me. Anyway, all right, so we were at the colony thing. So we started with sponges making a colony, or coral, or other things that did this in the previous version. And then the more advanced version, again, it kind of goes to a mob thing. Gangs win, individuals lose most of the time. It's just a probability equation that it's likely to turn out that way. This next stage for the individual-style organisms, the ones more like mammals or the reptiles or something like that, where not too many of them get much advantage out of a colony life, and wasn't conducive apparently to, there's herds of buffalo or some, obviously it was very successful to gang up, but there was lots of organisms still could really win the game by being sneakier. And part of the game is not to become a food source. Something, I've sort of made this argument. I haven't seen it written anywhere in any evolution books or stories of the story of our history, or how we got here. That it really would be an important feature of your evolution, not to be something other things depend on for food. You don't want to be the grass that gets eaten unless you have a backup plan, where they're fertilizing your soil and it's a give and take. So unless you can get into a symbiotic relationship, or one where your parasitism has advantage for both players, it's dangerous to be food. And so it would be some advantage to organisms not to be plentiful enough to be a food source. So they'd have to have, their plan would have to be stealth and being sneaky and, not too numerous and not too easy a meal, because then you end up having predators dependent on you, and that's the worst thing you want to have. Lots of little catches to evolution in terms of strategy that wins, that will end up with you winning. Not that you had a winning strategy, it just ends up with you winning because of luck a lot of the time, just circumstances. It rained more over there. You got a huge advantage because it rained on the other guy more than it rained on you. That kind of thing will decide fate. So anyway, so you have this structural, physical colony thing, and to some extent the mammals do this. They have families, and, you know, humans did tribes that were, you know, mostly just family, but, you know, a little extended. And then there was some advantage to exchanging members of your family groups just to end up with some more genetic diversity so you could keep up with the Joneses, because the Joneses, you know, sort of brought their advantages to your colony and kept you up to date on what the new innovations are, you know, the new successful changes to the molecule. And so there's huge advantage in keeping up with them by merely exchanging code with them, so you don't fall behind. And that becomes a kind of gang, too. You know, the gangs that did stay connected outperformed the ones who didn't. So the ones who stole code from the adversaries did better than the ones who didn't, you know, and so that was a successful strategy. Doing some genocide now and then was a good plan to have into the program, and that as soon as it looks like they're starting to, you know, encroach on your territory, so they become very territorial. You have to earn you own a certain amount of space, and there has to be certain rules of respecting that space, or you get killed. So lots of rules that make for success. And then for humans, the game changed, whatever, 40,000 years ago, somewhere in there, 30, 20, where they developed a more complex capacity to retain language. They, you know, had a crude mechanism for the process, and by just developing that crude mechanism, they ended up having made a much bigger mechanism. So as much as they were getting rewarded evolutionarily for doing a little bit of communicating, by making the little bit of communication, it made possible a lot of communication, in the sense that this became possible to put our knowledge in books and to write them down and to exchange them and to do it in you know, all these abstract ways. So there was, you know, the human beings that existed 200,000 years ago, you know, you could put them in high school and they might perform as well as us. Their brain function was there, they just didn't have anything in it. They didn't have any stored knowledge. They didn't have high school. They didn't have grammar school. They didn't have knowledge. So whatever, 10,000 years ago, we started getting good at this knowledge storage thing, started writing stuff down, learning from the past, and becoming civilized, but more importantly, becoming intelligent, knowledgeable, acquiring you know, decades and millennia of experience to base our actions on. Now, the danger of that was that some of these experiences weren't real. You know, people would write down, well, Joe says Sasquatch saved him from falling over a cliff. And so then Sasquatch becomes a real thing because he heard a Joe story. And, you know, Joe was just frankly, he used to call his wife Sasquatch, and it was really his wife who saved him. But, you know, it ends up being a story, as if it really happened. And then they, you know, build a monument to, you know, Sasquatch, and it's really Joe's wife. Because it, you know, and then 300 years later, they're still bowing to it, and, you know, still saying it's a reality when it's just the wrong, you know, they got the story wrong right from the beginning. It's just a silly story, silly little fables, but this is what we become in terms of the complexity of the world we can now live in. It takes us literally decades to become competent to be a storyteller or a story describer, to do any justice at all to explaining the history of mankind or the history of life on Earth or any of that, and doing any of this stuff, it, you know, takes literally decades of acquiring information and, you know, consuming and organizing to be able to even to converse about it. And there's just all kinds of opportunity for error. Somebody says something, you know, and Albert Einstein comes along and Just by happenstance and circumstance, he just falls into a couple of lucky coincidences where a couple of his predictions came true. But they didn't really, they weren't really true. They only came true because people misinterpreted an experiment or made a mistake. And so it all becomes kind of just junk that gets revered. And once it's revered, they have a hard time ever tearing anything down. And so the civilization gets dirtied. The knowledge of the civilization, the group knowledge, ends up full of a bunch of, you know, rubbish and crap that isn't really a true story, isn't a real event, isn't anything, and there's a big giant monument to it, and it's absolute garbage. So we're like making presidents out of, you know, lunatics, and, you know, merely because of a circumstance, because at the right time, you needed somebody to say whatever for your to defend some position, and you did it through a mechanism that's totally unaccountable and has no relevant. You've never seen him fail the way in doing the same thing. So you've seen him do other tricks and said, okay, he can do this trick too. Because he has no history, because he's never been tested. Anyway, I don't want to get into the politics thing, but it all drags into all of this stuff because it's so overtly a psychological events that are taking place, and it has nothing to do with any principles, any ideals, anything. It just has to do with the fact that the human perception has gotten so diverse and so broken into pieces. In terms of what's allowable to be believed, you know, there's now no longer a rational competition between ideas. You know, it doesn't have to make any sense. Nothing has to be sensible. It just has to be what's to the advantage of the group, and that's sort of what we've become. We've become separate, even though our DNA is still doing its little stupid thing, you know, in terms of creating the future and slating certain varieties of human being to termination as something that code is going to disappear. You know, and so it's becoming a new physical animal. The thing that's the group thing, the colonies, the families are still doing their thing. And it's a different kind of evolution. The social evolution, the ideas are evolving, and they're just going through a rough period in their evolution where they have created all this diversity, and it's toxic to function because now the fight, again, isn't happening in any disciplined gladiator arena where you have to tell the truth and whether there's rules and all that stuff. The game has just become a tacky game of control and taking advantage of, you know, any circumstance. It's just chaos, and, you know, there's no sensible rules for the survival of ideas or the success of a platform of suggested policy. But anyway, so that's, you know, that's an outline of the process. And so we're just these, you know, robots, basically, completely influenced by what language you grow up with, what culture, ethnic shit, all kinds of, in the family, what they consider is important is what you'll end up thinking is important, I suppose. You know, how much freedom you had as a kid to explore the world and make your own judgments. All of these things have huge impact on what you end up being as a person. You know, how rigid your bullshit is, and how reasonable you are, how capable you are of fixing errors you've made in the past in terms of what you've collected as symbolic understandings, how things even physically function, And I'd argue there's a huge, you know, some of the stuff is so glaring, you know, in terms of how stupid the arguments become. If you argue for any kind of liberal social policy, you'll be labeled as Stalin, you know. And if you argue for some sort of earned economy, you'll be labeled as, I can't even think of an icon of that would even match the brutality. I mean, you could say Mengele-esque, okay, you know, almost in terms of, you know, just sacrificing any rules of decency for some idea of I earned it because they're dead, now I'm alive. You know, that's the end of the story. I win at any, it doesn't matter how I played the game. And there's, you know, the reality isn't that stark. I mean, the idea of earning it is important in a civilization. That's whole, you know, deserve should have something to do with it. That's reward and punishment. Reward and punishment has to be allocated based on the behavior, not what you would wish it to be. You know, it's just the way it has to be. You have to punish bad behavior or you get more of it. And you have to reward good behavior or you get less of it. And so you can make I can make a simple argument about capitalism and say most of capitalism is semi-toothless and benign. It's just the inheritance thing where they just break the fundamental rule. I mean, the whole idea of capitalism is to have a nice, good fight, a nice, fair, clean fight to create a better product in the end. And you don't create better products by saying the guy who did it, his genetics did it. You know, not his life experience, not how his parents raised him, not the environment he was raised in or the decade he was raised in or any of that. That didn't have anything to do with it. Somehow his genetics is what you're rewarding. And that's just silly. It's got no chance that the genetic factor is such a tiny influence on success in terms of complex success that's based on understanding how to, you know, the economics of a system or something like that. I mean, Bill Gates doesn't have great genetics. It's not what made him successful. You know, it's that at an early enough age, he read enough books to understand chicanery. He understood how, hey, you know, if I can get these guys to rent this thing, I can get paid forever. Instead of just buying it outright, of course. So, I mean, just simple things like that. You know, simple gimmicks is what made most of them. And once you have inheritance, then you just broke your evolution. Your evolution can't work, ironically, when you let them just inherit it and not have to re-earn it, not have to prove that they gained a skill, that they have the power. If they don't have to prove it anymore, then the likelihood is the power doesn't exist in them anymore. And like I said, there's no reason to believe it ever existed in the first place as a genetic power. You know, it was a circumstantial power. And it's a simple argument. So if you let inheritance dominate the ownership of wealth, you've broken any kind of reasonable capitalist theme. It's just ruined. So it just becomes a monarchy in a sense. It just becomes some stupid thing where you say, oh, the king is going to give birth to somebody just as smart as him. Just as capable of him, just as calm and sensible and well-disciplined as him, when you know that kids aren't born that way and it doesn't work that way. He had to earn it by winning a couple of wars. The kid will never do that. He won't have the same strengths. He'll have a whole different set of strengths and weaknesses, and you'd be better off electing a king than having one pop out of a vagina and say it's king. It's just silly. It's a silly ethic. It's obviously so opposite to any kind of concept of earned and deserve. And, but there's all these people fanatically defend it. They're fanatically devoted to it. It somehow is the essence of capitalism, is to create this unearned reality. You know, to do something exactly the opposite of what your intent is. Exactly the opposite. All right, I don't know if I wanted to get into that subject, but I did. So, tough. that's where we ended up. All right, now I'll take a little break and see if I have any closing remarks. Maybe we'll deal with an outline of the stupid criticisms. I mean, they're just such ignorant criticisms being made. We'll come back and do a couple of, didn't play any of these, but they're just by the title. They're worthy of some comment. So, be back shortly. All right, let's finish up. Make sure we're recording. Looks like it. Okay, no failures, apparently. No failures yet. So the first argument, water is not wet, cats get wet. As stated, the only purpose of this statement is just to demonstrate that there are certain words that were invented to describe very fundamental things that happen, very obvious things, right, left, things that have an obvious and certain reality, that there's a difference between that way and that way, and they're opposite ways, and that they should have different words to describe what they are. And if you say something turned right, it turned right. Yes, you got it right. It's an accurate statement. We can make accurate statements about reality because a lot of the language is simple and unrefutable as a concept. And it just doesn't need to be argued. We don't need people doing silly minutiae, pretending that the word doesn't have a very solid meaning and a solid definition, and that we all can understand the concept, the difference between 2 and 4, for example. These are solid things. Understanding the relationship that there's 2 twos in 4, solid stuff. Realistically, if people are going to doubt those solid things, then how can you have any conversation about anything at all and talk about right or wrong or good or bad or profit or loss? If you can't, you can't even accept the concept of profit and loss, of plus and minus. You're doubtful of their reality. You're too pathetic. Imposition argument is worst starting argument. So somehow I've been falsely labeled as somebody who makes imposition arguments constantly. I think it's a great argument if somebody refuses, if somebody just wants to refuse to play the game and understand evolution and understand that we're robots and that it's determinism and, the sad truth of our existence, and it's all kind of a pathetic struggle for nothing. They don't wish to understand, this Shakespearean tragedy of it as a truth, as how life does end in just this pitiful, miserable death, blah, blah, blah. They don't want to understand that story. It's really easy for everybody to understand. I don't like somebody telling me, I know what's good for you. they wouldn't want somebody else controlling their life, telling them what they can and can't do, what's good for them, what's bad for them, all of that stuff. So imposition is a concept everybody can understand. And it's such an overt imposition of risk is the real important part. You're not imposing nothing, you're imposing something. And the something is entirely covered in risk. It's a huge pile of what you're imposing, and that again, I've used metaphors that are kind of obvious, that you if you're completely certain you're going to go to Las Vegas and you're going to win, and you say, gee, I'll do my neighbor a favor, I know where he hides his money, I'll steal his money because he's not home, and I'll go gamble with it in Las Vegas because I'm sure I'm going to win, no problem. And so why not make as much money as possible, take as much investment capital with me as possible because I'm quite certain I'm going to win. Well, everybody'd say, fine, yeah, if you're certain you're going to win, go ahead. But that's not how you can go into giving birth or creating life. There's no certainty about the winning. None at all. No reasonable prospect of a certainty is involved at all. It's not reasonable to believe it. And so you're imposing risk. And articulating how substantial that risk is and explaining how substantial it is indicates it. So what's your authority to impose a risk? And one of the ways you gain authority is through the idea of consent. If my neighbors consent to me going to Las Vegas and risking their money. It's not on me, it's on them. I'm completely innocent. I'm doing them a favor. Okay, but if they don't consent, then I have to be right. And that's the truth of it. I have to know it's going to be right. I have to be certain. And nobody can be that about the risks of creation. You have no reasonable way to be certain. You're just hoping, and you don't have a right to, I hope I'll win with your money. You know, that kind of thing. Well, anyway, I think it's an incredibly powerful argument. Imposition is the essence of the crime being committed, because we have knowledge of risk. Animals can't impose because they're robots in a narrow sense. They haven't been able to do this experience thing. So they're like a brand new Coke machine. He just knows how to make Coke. He doesn't know that all the other Coke machines are conspiring to, you know, make the dopey guy who punches the buttons too hard go to his machine. And so, you know, he's getting beat up every day because he hasn't had enough life experience to know that that's the routine. He's in the position, you know, they made sure all the other Coke machines through experience learned to move over and say, oh, okay, let him go there where the new machine goes. You know, I mean, that's the nature of this game is acquiring knowledge. And this is another guy who says there's no such thing as knowledge. Knowledge is some sort of complex thing or something nuanced or some sort of bullshit. When no, it's just understanding, and you can understand something correctly or incorrectly. You can tell a story accurately or inaccurately. That's all there is. All right. It says crap, C-R-A-P, that is consumption, reproduction, addiction, and parasitism, is convoluted crap argument. When it's obviously, because of the acronym, it's intended to be completely concise and unconvoluted. It's making it quite clear that this is what we're here doing. We're consuming for the purpose of reproducing, a process of addiction, and the end result is you end up parasiting. To have, somebody else has to not have. And in more extreme cases, to have, you have to exploit or force something else to be a slave to your needs. Completely reasonable, sensible way to understand the truth of our existence. Crap is the truth of our existence. So he isn't explaining how life isn't consumption for the purpose of reproduction, driven for most of the sentient organisms by mechanical addictions, and incredibly parasitic. It's just makes victims. They're all predators, and nothing exists without some measure of predation on either its brother and sister, or on some other organism. Irrefutable claims of objective truth are crap. Irrefutable claims is, you know, an interesting statement. I would argue there's a ton of irrefutable claims that can be made about our existence, about what a human being is, and what life is, and what the universe is, and how the physics works, and a lot of it's irrefutable in the sense the evidence is complete, and it's unmurky. It's not indecisive or contradictory, or, you know, the record is quite clear and it points in one clear direction, and there are solid assertions that can be made. And it's just silly to say there's no such thing as a rock solid assertion. and then he says irrefutable claims of subjective truth. It depends on what you mean by subjective. If you're saying love is so cool, okay, yeah, that's just mush. You can't say that as an irrefutable claim. Okay, because it's not only refutable, you can refute it just by saying, what the hell are you talking about when you say love? What do you mean? Sex? What are you talking about? What kind of love are you talking about? And then there's the other subjective, where is you personally experience. Now, I would argue there's nothing wrong with personal experience. If a squirrel actually does knock on my window and tell me to do something, it's a fact that it's a subjective experience. A squirrel only talked to me. And it's going to be a fact that I'm going to find it. Whatever he's going to say, I'm going to pay attention because a fucking squirrel's telling me it. Those are going to be facts. So a lot of what we experience subjectively, I'm experiencing my personal consciousness personally. And I can testify to it, and I can believe it's real and be perfectly rational. And it's kind of irrefutable. You can't claim I'm not having consciousness, I'm not doing this, the things I'm testifying to. You have no evidence that any of the statements I'll make about my own consciousness are untrue. So they're irrefutable in the sense that you have absolutely no evidence that I'm a cyborg or some other thing you would try to indicate I am, some sort of thing that's testifying to something that's not true. I'm saying I have feelings. They're very different, negative, positive, if you can understand it that way, good, bad, relief and tension, two kind of opposite concepts, relaxation and aggravation, however to describe the two most precisely. Again, I would argue there's, we're whipped and then we're not whipped. There is no real good. But anyway, and I think those claims can be defended, and they can be defended so well that they're irrefutable to anything. They're indestructible to any argument except some crazy argument from somebody who's talking to squirrels or gods. Worse, I guess, right? That's even worse, talking to gods. So anyway, these are just nonsense accusations and silly jargon and irrational and disconnected mush that I don't see any there's a wish that somehow we should have conversation about this. Why was there to converse about? I completely and fundamentally disagree with you. I think understanding is a real thing. You develop it, you test it, and it becomes stronger. Statements can be proven to be durable and strong and worthy of belief. And statements can be proven to be weak and silly and stupid and unworthy of belief. And that's a real thing that happens in the real world. Can anything be proven beyond what? all we have is the standard of reasoning. All we have is the standard of a good argument. And I think things can be proven beyond counter-argument. Reasonable counter-argument. If you want to call that reasonable doubt, fine. But that's the standard. I've never advocated for any other standard. That's all we've got. There are lots of things that can be believed with great certainty because the amount of evidence is so overwhelming, and the amount of counter theory, the possibility of constructing a reasonable counter theory is so impossible or undemonstrated to be possible that you have to go with it. We can only do our best, and our best is to be usefully decisive. And you're kind of, this vague argument that somehow everything's some sort of 50-50 thing, it's decision is impossible. it's just nonsense. All right, anyway, so enough of that useless crap. So anyway, this looks like a better way to organize my desktop. There are things about Linux that are annoying. I mean, this version of Linux Mint doesn't let you save your settings. When you turn the computer off, it doesn't wake up and put everything back the way it was, which is a very nice feature. It doesn't do that. So anyway, if it didn't crash now and then, this wouldn't be a problem, but it crashes a little bit too often, so I have to restart everything, and it's such a hassle. So I figure if I put it into the background, then I don't have to, I don't have to keep regenerating things. But anyway, a little personal bit. I think that's enough. So till the next time and such, maybe try to make a video during the week and do some more of this compiling of a description of the reality that is, making it complete and concise, making it as compact but as full, giving it as much mass in the smallest space, the fewest words and the greatest mass. this is a complex bit of physics to be doing, psychological and philosophical physics. So anyway, I haven't gotten great at it yet, so I'll work on that. So anyway, till the next time. Appreciate your attention and such.